Well, let's read this text. Our sermon text this morning is 1 Corinthians 7, verses 25 through 40. We're about to wrap up this section of the Apostle Paul's argument. He's been responding to a question, or partly a question and partly some comments, some statements of belief that the Corinthians had. And he's looking back at these things and giving his comments on them. Let me read to you these verses for this morning. Now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the present distress, it's good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you've not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she's not sinned. Yet those who marry will have many worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone thinks that he's not behaving properly towards his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It's no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control and has determined in his heart, has determined this in his heart, to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So then, he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she's free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Yet, in my judgment, she's happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I, too, have the Spirit of God. This is the word of the Lord. Well, I think I've told you before that I'm not a big fan, even of the magic eye pictures. They're not as popular now as they used to be. They used to be all over the place. But they're the pictures that you look at it and it just looks like a bunch of squiggles and designs. And what you're supposed to do is stare at it for long enough that a 3D image kind of pops out. Has everybody seen these? Okay, I don't like those. As a guy that has poor eyesight, it just sort of adds insult to injury. It's basically what goes on. Because I'm like, I can't see anyway. Now I can't see this. But anyhow, the thing about them, though, is that they make a really handy illustration. Because sometimes when we look at a sermon text, similar to what we saw last week, there are all these details, all these circumstances in this text, and we could, as we look at those, kind of get lost in all the details. Remember last week we said it might seem like they're disconnected. In this case, they might seem kind of connected, but we still might wonder, well, what's the big image that's supposed to pop out? I've got all these scenarios, all these circumstances. What's the big point here? Well, what Paul's doing here, again, he's continuing on in this section of the letter, dealing with issues of, at least it seems on the surface, dealing with issues of marriage or not marriage, and all these kinds of relationships, sex and sexuality, all that stuff that's going on that we started, especially in chapter 7:1, so last week's passage, and now we are kind of at the tail end of this morning. And what he's doing is he's taking the command of Jesus about marriage, which we saw back in chapter 7, verse 10, on the permanence of marriage, and he's applying it to these specific circumstances. Now, the problem is, again, we might look at what he's doing here and see just only the details and not really catch what's the big 3D image that's supposed to pop out. Well, with that in mind, my hope is that what we can do is let's look at the various circumstances that Paul's talking and speaking into. Let's take a look at those and then see if, having looked at the details, we can catch the big 3D image. All right, that's my plan for this morning. This sermon's going to be about that artful. But anyway, here we go. Let's take a look at these circumstances that will help us see the bigger picture. The first one that we need to pay attention to is in verse 26. Now, I should say, too, this is a notoriously tough passage. Pieces of this passage are notoriously difficult. A pastor knows he's in trouble when he's reading a commentary, and one of the commentators says, I offer my suggestions with the utmost trembling. I'm thinking, well, great. Thanks. Anyway, we need to deal with this question of verse 26. In verse 26, Paul talks about the present distress. That's the ESV's translation of it. What is it that Paul is referring to here? Now, some people look at this issue of the present distress and understanding it in relation to verse 29, where Paul talks about the shortness of time, which is something we'll talk about in a minute. They connect those two together, and the assumption then is that what Paul is doing is that he views the second coming of Christ as imminent, if not immediate. So Paul's assumption is that it's at least going to come next, but it's probably coming like really, really, really soon. Now, some of Paul's language in 2 Corinthians might soften how soon he thought it was coming. But that's kind of the idea, that the assumption then is that the second coming is going to be really soon, so the time's short. So his instructions about marriage or not marriage, all those things like that, are related to this segment of time. That's a possibility. I think it's actually better to understand this issue, the present distress, as referring to current events in Corinth. We do know that from Acts 11 and from other ancient writings around that time, that there was actually a severe famine happening in the Roman Empire during this time when Paul is writing. And if there is a severe famine in the Roman Empire, it would make sense that Paul is talking about these relationship circumstances with that distress in view, the lack of food, the uncertainty of it. I don't think that means that there's no eschatological impulse. We'll get to that in a second, too. I don't think that's completely out of his mind. However, I think that the present distress is talking about these like on-the-ground problems in Corinth, particularly this famine. All right, so that's the present distress. That's how I'm going to look at that verse, verse 26. But let's look now at some of these relational circumstances, because much like we saw in the first part of chapter 7, Paul speaks into several different categories. I'll use the term categories of relationships to offer his instruction applying what Jesus has said. The first one of those is he speaks to those who are married. Now, starting with those who are married, Paul says basically in verses 28, 36, and 38, marriage is fine. Right? Remember that the Corinthians had been basically questioning, should people be married now? Isn't it more spiritual to not? And Paul says, marriage is fine. Now sure, marriage comes with some challenges. There are challenges in marriage because a person is divided. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be read in a pejorative sense, as though they're not as devoted to Jesus. I don't think that's Paul's point. His point, especially if we keep in mind the present distress, is that the married person has lots of things to think about. They can't just do whatever they want. And that's a challenge for someone who's really pursuing kingdom life and ministry. I will tell you firsthand, though I'm thrilled to be married, Danielle, I love being married. But it does have some challenges when you're trying to devote yourself to kingdom work. There are things that I just can't up and do because I have people at home that are depending on me. And that's okay. But it is a challenge sometimes. And Paul is saying, yeah, look, marriage comes with challenges. But he also says, but it's a good thing. Marriage is good. Pragmatically speaking, the married person is divided. But for Paul to take a low view of marriage would be hard to reconcile with his insistence that marriage is so theologically loaded. Paul has said already in 1 Corinthians, he'll say in Ephesians, marriage is a big deal. It's a good thing. So even in light of the present distress, for those that are saying, no, listen, maybe marriage is not the way to go, he says, no, listen, marriage is fine. Marriage is good. But let's look at another reference that Paul makes to a different group of people. These are the unmarried, the singles. Now here we just have to go ahead and say it. Paul likes singleness. Paul thinks singleness is a great thing. I mean, in verse 40, look at verse 40. Paul, in my judgment, she's even happier if she stays single. Now, we said last week that Paul, maybe it was a little bit of a passing thought, when Paul talks about being gifted to celibacy, I think that he's talking about in his instance that issues of sexual desire are not a big thing for Paul. He doesn't expect that of everyone. He doesn't think that of every single person. But for him, that's a gift. But even for those that don't have that gift, Paul is saying, listen, given the circumstances of this famine, there's some significant practical advantages to singleness. Paul likes singleness. Paul likes singleness here. Paul likes singleness in other areas. The single person has the ability to live in untethered devotion to Jesus. So Paul says, this is great. Singleness. Go singleness. Singleness is also good. Now notice again another category here that Paul speaks to those who were once married. In verses 30 and 39, well, I should look closer. Verses 39 to 40, Paul talks to those who were once married but now have been widowed. You might remember that from last week. And Paul reiterates what he's already said. His point here is that the standard for marriage is still permanence, but there are circumstances that impinge on that standard. Death is one of them. A woman or also a man in the same situation whose spouse has died is free to remarry another follower of Jesus. And I would add as an aside, from Matthew 19, I believe that the same instruction goes for one whose marriage ends because of sexual immorality. But the point here is that for those who were formerly married in this circumstances as they are, listen, marriage is good. And so is singleness. Singleness is also good. Both are good. Then let's look at one last circumstance before we take a turn here. And this one is the hardest one to parse out. When Paul refers to the betrothed, right there at the beginning in verse 25, that is a notorious exegetical conundrum. What's he talking about the betrothed? It could be that Paul is speaking to fathers who have set up marriages for their daughters. They've prepared marriages. They're supposed to get married. That's kind of the plan. But now, these fathers are feeling the strain from those that are saying that marriage is bad spiritually. They're feeling the strain from that, or they're feeling the strain from the famine. And now they're wondering, is it a good idea? Is it good for me to marry my daughter, to get her to marry off my daughter or something like that? That's one way we could read this part of the text. That's not certain, though. It could also refer to those who had planned to get married themselves but were having second thoughts because of these same questions. But when we look at verses 36 to 38, I think those verses help us see what's the challenge essentially. And it's this: there were some in Corinth that weren't married but wanted to be. They wanted to be married. But what are we supposed to do? I mean, there are these circumstances of the famine, I would suggest that's the issue. There's that. There are these words from other people that saying maybe marriage isn't a good thing. We're not sure what to do, but at the end of the day, they'd really like to be married. What are they supposed to do? Paul says his instruction is that, listen, to get married's a good thing. I mean, even if singleness has some pragmatic advantages, to get married if you want to, that's fine. Because, again, marriage, it's really good. And singleness, it's also good. Now, those are the circumstances here. But let's make a turn, because we have to acknowledge at this point, I want to acknowledge at this point, these are hard passages for a lot of people. As I've studied these passages over the last couple weeks, I've had many friends' faces in mind. Some of you, others. These are teachings in the Scripture that really press on some bruises that many of you carry. And I will tell you, my heart hurt as I thought about these passages this week. What do we do with these passages when it's not just letters on a page, when there are names that go with them that are wrestling with questions of their own marriage, their own singleness, their desires for marriage, their questions about divorce? These are not just letters on a page that we can look at without having people's names attached. And my heart aches as I look at these things, because I know the questions that the Corinthians were dealing with are the questions that many of you have. The heart issues underneath the questions for the Corinthians are the heart issues that many of you have. What are we supposed to do in these circumstances? Well, my heart also aches because I know that the church has a pretty checkered history on these topics. And by church, I mean the Big C Church, the whole collection of all the Christian church across traditions. We've got a pretty checkered history on issues of marriage and singleness. At times, the church has upheld marriage as the gold standard for the Christian walk. perhaps unintentionally, perhaps, in my notes, perhaps is in parentheses here, perhaps unintentionally, sometimes within the life of the church, those that are not married kind of get viewed as kind of second status. So like there's two categories. There's married people, then there's those that are kind of waiting to get married, and one day maybe they'll get on board. It's sometimes unintentional, but I imagine it's not all that great for people that are single. I think that there's been a bit of a Freudian creep into our view of what is the core of a person, as though everything hinges on sexual intercourse. And sometimes all of this gets communicated that even an unhealthy marriage is better than being single. And that is not the view of Paul. That is not the view of the New Testament. When we look at this letter, what we see is that Paul takes a very high view of singleness. A very high view of singleness. To Paul, singleness is a really good thing. I think we should see singleness that way too. But at other times, the church has conversely held up celibacy as almost like a higher form of spirituality. As though, really, the people that can be that can live their lives as celibate people, as people that are following Jesus, as singles, those people must be really spiritually elite. They're the ones that really have it together. Again, with that bit of a Freudian creep, sometimes we say, I mean, I could never do that, but that super spiritual person, they can do it. And that's great. Go singleness. Now, Paul's view is not that singleness is the true way for only the spiritually elite. Paul takes a very high view of marriage. We see that in Ephesians 5 and other places, and I believe that the church should take a high view of marriage too. And further, I would imagine, I've been married since I was in, you know, elementary school, it seems like, but not quite that long. Been married a long time. I did not have a lot of reference points as a single person before being married at the age of 21. But I can imagine, at least, that elite view of singleness, that sense that the single people, those are the spiritually elite. Only those people that really have their spiritual act together, they're the ones that can do all that singleness stuff. I would imagine that puts a huge burden on single people who don't feel super spiritual. I'd imagine that view puts a big burden on single people that really don't want to be single, thank you very much. What about them? See, what we see in this text, though, is that Paul is saying that both marriage and singleness are good. And what he says to the church in Corinth is that, listen, these questions that you have about marriage and singleness, I don't want you to be anxious about these things. These things should not be a source of anxiety for you, as though where you are in your relationship to other people with marriage or singleness, that these are the hinge on which your spirituality turns. Whatever your relational circumstances, you don't have to be anxious that you're spiritually deficit, you're at a spiritual deficit. And it's not that the questions are unimportant, he's not saying that. Because he's investing a measure of time in helping answer their questions about the very things. These are important issues. But the Apostle Paul doesn't want people to be anxious about them because these are not the issues on which your spirituality turns. Now think with me back to this whole magic eye 3D picture thing. As I've said, I find them super frustrating. Because sometimes you can stare at all the details and wonder if it's like a big prank, you know, when you're staring at the wall and you wonder, somebody watching me just stare at this. They can be super frustrating because you really want to know, like, what's the big image in here? What's supposed to come out at me? I'm hoping that we can get to that now. Because with all of these different sets of circumstances, my argument is that Paul is saying marriage, singleness, they're both really good. But what do we do with those things? What do we do as married or single people? How do we live this out, though? I think we have a huge help in verses 29 to 31. These are the passages where Paul says, this is what I mean, brothers, the appointed time. By brothers, I'll keep saying, he's referring to all the family members in the household, male and female. This is what I mean, brothers, the appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. Those who mourn as though they were not mourning. Those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away. What is Paul doing here? We get some help with that when we kind of dig around. And what does Paul mean by the time has grown very short? That's in verses 29. Now, this is a really, really hard word to translate. That the time has grown very short is translating one word. And that one word means something like the time or the age has right now been compressed. The idea is that because Jesus died and rose again and reigns from the right hand of the Father, the future has been pressed back into now. The age to come has been just broken back into the present because of the resurrection of Jesus. Time has been compressed. The promise of Jesus' return, the hope of our resurrection, that thing that we see, our resurrection out in the future, that's being pressed back into the now. Time has been compressed. The promise of Jesus' return, the hope of our resurrection, this coming age when everything is going to be the way it's supposed to be, that sort of already but not yet complete upon us kind of idea, all of that stuff that's out there in the future, the reign, the full reign and rule of Jesus in his resurrection glory, is being brought to bear, breaking back into the current age, into our time, into our circumstances, into our lives, into our relationships. The point then of these pivotal verses, I would suggest to you, is that the circumstances of our lives, including these sometimes really gut-wrenching questions about things like marriage and singleness and divorce and all of these things that stir in our lives, because the time has been compressed, because the future reign of Christ, the full future reign of Christ is being brought to bear now, what Paul is saying in these verses about those that are married, act like you're not, all that kind of stuff, what he's saying then, I believe, is this. These issues, these gut-wrenching questions about marriage and singleness and divorce and all the rest, those things, those really good questions that we need to deal with, those things cannot be the governing factor on how we approach our lives. We must live according to the age to come, with its hopes, with its values, with its promises, and live according to those things now, in this age. What I mean as a married person is that the governing factor of my life cannot be my marriage. The governing factor of my life needs to be that the future realities of Jesus' present reign are being brought forward into now. That will absolutely have bearing on how I approach my marriage. It'll have bearing on how I relate to other people outside my marriage. It has bearing on where Danielle and I and our kids live or don't live, how we spend or don't spend our money, whether we open the doors of our home to others, which we should, whether our primary place of responsibility is to the Spencer name, it isn't. The future realities of the reign of Jesus are breaking in on the world now. Our married life, Danielle and my married life, is to be lived together based on that reality. That is the fundamental hinge on which everything must turn. Our vocations, our parenting, even our sex, works itself around this thing, that Christ's present reign and the future realities are breaking into this age now. Well, as a single person, the governing factor of your life can't be your singleness. Or, and hear me carefully here, the governing factor of your life can't be your desire for marriage, if that's you. The governing factor, the hinge upon which our lives must turn, is the future reality of Jesus' present reign being brought to bear right now. Everything else you do, your vocation, your plans for the future, even your desire to be married, all of those things have to move around, they orbit around the gravity of the reign and rule of Christ now. Now, that everything else that moves around the reign and rule of Christ also includes how you put yourself in a position to not be single anymore. How do you approach that? the present reign and rule of Christ from heaven affects that. And I want to be sure to say to those of you that are single this morning that the desire for marriage is not a bad thing. Marriage is good. Singleness is too, but the desire for marriage is not a bad thing. But it also can't be an ultimate thing, a life-governing thing. But think about what our lives, whether married or single, might look like if it was Jesus' kingdom values that govern where we went, how we worked, how we spent, who we spent our time around. For most of us, it wouldn't change our addresses or the office cubicles that we sit in. It wouldn't change those things. Necessarily, for some of you, it might. But it might completely change how we lived out our marriedness or our singleness. How we approach what it means to be a married person in a family. What it means for some of you to be single people. To take all the gifts and challenges associated with both and live them out based on the present rule of Christ. The future kingdom reality is being brought to bear now. I think it would change how we live out our marriedness or our singleness. And I also have a hunch, by the way, that if we lived our lives according to Jesus in breaking kingdom, this compressing of time, that single people and married people would be a huge blessing to each other. I'm not sure that it always works that way. But the realities of the reign of Christ calls it to work that way. Now, when I've had the privileges of talking to couples about the prospect of marriage, some of you have endured those conversations with me. I count that an honor, by the way. Just want to make sure I say that out loud. If you've ever sat with me and talked about marriage, I think it's totally great that you even invite a guy like me to talk about it. So anyway, that said, though, I will invariably, I mean, this is, it's on the paper I hand out and everything. I will absolutely invariably at some point get around to the question of what's going to be the fundamental authority for your marriage? Might seem like a funny question, but when the proverbial push comes to shove, as it's going to, as it will, what's going to determine how you approach your circumstances? Is it going to be your preferences? Is it going to be your personalities? Is it going to be your passions? Or the one that's even harder to work through is going to be your parents? What's going to be the thing that when life really hits and you're going, what do we do now? What's going to be the thing that like everything has to move around? I've seen in lots of marriages all four of those things be the thing. Something is going to be the fundamental guide. And that's true in any relationship. In any relationship, whether married or not. When push comes to shove, there will be that thing that happens. And in any relationship, what's going to be the fundamental guide that you base your decisions on? That's the question I like to ask. It's super obnoxious, and it always makes people go, what's he talking about? And they work it all out. It's great fun for me, and anyway, there's that. But the reality is this. There are some people that have all the gifts and advantages that go with marriage, and that's a good thing. And some do not. There are some people that have all the gifts and advantages that go with singleness, and that's a good thing. Some do not. Some have the particular gift for celibacy. Some do not. But for those who are married, and for those who are not, for those who were married, and for those for whom marriage is just not an option right now, even if you wish it were, I want to say to you that the resurrection reign of Jesus is right now breaking its way into the present as God's people live out their lives by the Spirit. Take that back to chapter 2, verses 6 and beyond. Whatever your relational status, that language sort of freaks me out a little bit, but I'm going to use it anyway. Whatever your relationship is, the resurrection reign of Jesus is right now breaking into your life as we as God's people live by the Spirit. And that is the fundamental life-governing reality to which all of our lives must bend together. That's the issue. And it is the practical means by which we live in our circumstances with all of our wishes, with all of our hopes, with all of our desires and longings. The reality is that Christ is coming. We've been singing about that in this service. Christ is coming. And that coming is breaking its way into our age now because of the work of the Spirit. So my hope for us, my exhortation to us, is that right now, in whatever circumstances we find ourselves, that we would bend ourselves, bend our lives to that coming age. Let me pray. Father in heaven, I know that questions of marriage and singleness and all these things, these are not easy issues. This is not an easy text. But thank you that the Spirit's at work. And my prayer now, sort of on the back end, is that perhaps in my study and my attempt to share this with these friends, that your Spirit would be at work to strengthen us, to set our sights on, to build our lives around, whatever metaphor will take root, Lord, around the present reign of Christ. Lord, we long for the day that you would come. Until then, help us to live our lives according to that inbreaking kingdom. We pray these things in hope and in Jesus' name. Amen.